got Lou, we got the other guys on a different schedule today because it's Labor Day. No, he's at 45, and the other guy's in a car the last half hour. Whenever you want.
Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million, if I had $1 million, well, I'd buy you a house. I would buy
you. You can't handle the truth.
And if I had $1 million.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here.
Stocks and Jocks.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm talking about Jimmy on the board. S&P futures down 2. NASDAQ futures down 106. We had a wild day yesterday with the NASDAQ down pretty heavy, mostly because of Micron was down 110, but some stocks in that group were up. Micron was up. Google, I think, was up, but some of the rest of them were down. We're getting this back and forth within the 7. Do we have Professor Lou?
Good morning, sir.
Now, here's a guy that can handle the truth, this Lou dude. Huh. What is the truth? Tell me the truth.
The truth about, well, let's start with the truth about the U.S. men's national team, which does not look like a U.S. And Jimmy may have a better idea on this because he's more of a fan, but these guys do not look like a U.S. soccer team.
There's nobody from any college that's playing on this team. Nobody in college is good enough to play on one of these teams, right? Is that the idea? They're all guys that play in pro league someplace.
And we have finally we got a coach
they're foreign
that
I mean they
understands how to play the game. And we Yelsich, I mean Pulisic plays in Europe. Most of them play in Europe now. We finally got that part over with that playing in the MLS here is not you're not
no.
going to
No, the MLS I went to see it. Have you gone to see an MLS game, Chief?
I've never. No,
they're horrible. I mean, for the most part.
Well, isn't our goalkeeper from the MLS though?
I don't know.
I think he is. He's the one guy.
Having gone to see a couple of MLS games here in Denver, it looks like, it was just really boring. It just no creativity, no movement. Very set plays, very set movement patterns among the players. I just watching these guys are the current U.S. men's team. The first time I saw them play against Paraguay, I was absolutely astounded at how fast they were, and how creatively they were moving the ball around and passing. And I just thought. These guys don't look like a U.S. team. These guys look almost like a European or even better.
Well, they've been given some chance to win. I mean, it's not like they've given like a zero chance to win.
Which is in itself amazing as well.
Yeah.
So just that was one thing I noted in terms of watching the matches. And I don't have the time to sit and watch an entire soccer. Entire soccer game. What I'm doing is catching the FIFA highlights, which actually have been very good in terms of how they're clipping the sequences. So they'll clip a sequence that'll lead to something. So you get to see how off a set piece like a corner kick or a goal kick, or some other kind of or offset piece off a foul, and then watch how a play develops. So FIFA's been really good about putting that stuff into the highlight reel. But so that was one thing that jumped out at me, was that this U.S. team does not look like a traditional U.S. team. These guys are creative, they're fast, they're skilled, their foot skills and all that, ball handling skills are really good. And I heard a commentator yesterday say that, you know, teams like Bosnia and Herzegovina and even a team like Paraguay, which looks pretty good, they traditionally would have provided us with fits, because they tend to fall back and play more of a defensive game and then wait for something to happen to break out and score a quick goal and then fall back into their defensive pattern. And the commentator said what the U.S. now has the capability of doing is pressing these guys with speed and aggressiveness because of their ball handling skills and their playmaking skills, and that kind of style of play that the U.S. is capable of doing can be a real problem for more defensive-minded teams. And it was for Paraguay, and it was for Bosnia yesterday. So,
well, speed kind of works in every sport, Lou.
Speed kills, and which goes to my second point. I've heard discussion within the soccer world about the opening up of the teams or availability of teams for the World Cup and expanding the initial draw, and that there were a lot of teams in there, and there was some discussion about from Africa who were not qualified. We just didn't have the soccer programs to make this thing work. So I've been watching, you know, Ivory Coast and the Congo and a couple of other, it's now DR Congo, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, watching those teams play and noticing, and I'm sure you have as well, and I know Jimmy has, noticing, for example, that the French team is predominantly African. A number of these teams, the British team has a large number of Jamaican black players, and the world is starting to pick up on the fact that, you know, African players have, as much as we have in our sports that demand speed and athletic, just sheer athleticism, the African players have a tremendous amount of sheer athleticism. And when you get some skill tacked onto that, which is what you saw with the Ivory Coast England game yesterday, when you get some soccer skill tacked onto that, it is a nightmare for these traditional FIFA powerhouses like England. You know, the DR Congo took England all the way to the very end, and if it hadn't been for some tremendous goalkeeping by the English goalie, would have probably beaten them. And so these clubs from I think Africa is going to be the marker, but these clubs from Africa, as they get coached better, as their skill and their national programs develop more, just the sheer athleticism of the people coming out of that area.
A bunch of million people, they all play the game, and you got to end up with 15 guys. You're going to be able to find 15 guys that are good.
But my point is that the world is discovering something that we have noted.
Yep.
Which is that certain areas of much as certain areas of Africa produce world-class runners, distance runners, certain areas of Africa produce people that are really fast, really quick, with tremendous athletic ability, and they're now being coached up so that the technical skills of soccer, you know, merge with that tremendous athletic ability. And I think it's going to provide some real problems for the traditional FIFA powers. And well, Jimmy, jump in on that. I'm talking through my hat.
No, what's interesting about, I don't read that much history about Africa, but I did reading some genetic stuff one time, and you look at the, you know, Africa, okay, they're all black, you could say idiotly. There's supposedly a greater spread in gene, more variations in genes in Africa than like in any other country, because they've been there so long that some of those groups have totally, you know, not totally, but I mean, most people's genes are what, 99% of the guy standing next to them, right? They actually have a bigger spread because the area is the oldest. So some of the areas where you see some of the guys are like real tall, and some other guy areas they're not. They actually have a bigger, just because they're black. You might be dumb and say, well, they're all black, they're the same. No, they're not. There's actually a greater disparity in genes and in different
variation
in Africa than virtually any place else. I mean, that's the last thing you would guess.
Well, I haven't seen that, but I do know, for example, that certain populations in Africa, for example, have a tremendous advantage in terms of distance running.
Yeah,
because their slow twitch muscle mass is genetically different than the normal population.
But they're so totally different than the black guy who's the fastest sprinter.
Yeah. Well, this goes to your variation thing. In addition, you have within that population a tremendous, a huge cohort of people that have are genetically granted with fast twitch muscle mass, and that translates directly into speed and again the explosive power that I think is going to ultimately dominate a sport like soccer.
Well, people don't have a whole lot of respect sometimes for the natural selection process. I mean, which, you know, respect for it. I mean, I'm not respecting it like a person, but I read this thing once, and somebody said, "Why don't people die from bubonic plague like they used to?" I mean, you can, I guess, but by and large, you know, part of it's antibiotics. And the guy said, "It's simple. Somewhere along the line, some ancestor of yours survived it.
Yeah,
and you have somewhere buried a little bit of an antibody towards it.
A disease that killed what, 25% of the population of Europe in the 1300s.
Yep."
Gradually, we selected for people who could survive it. In any event, that's just something I noted, was that the teams coming out of Africa, which were being given initially short shrift because their programs were not historically, you know, big soccer programs. Once you tap into that athletic ability and that screen for the guys that they you know, naturally have, or that have these natural tendencies toward this kind of explosive skill, you're going to be having some really good teams. And I just watched these guys against the Congo against England yesterday, and what you saw in just straight line speed. I mean, it was a real problem for the English team to. Within the first 15-20 minutes, you could see them saying, "Wait a minute, we got to change what we're doing out here, because what I'm getting here are guys that can run a lot faster with the ball than we're used to, and are just explosively just getting by us."
We've had Mike Murphy on every Wednesday to talk, and next week I'm going to try and ask him, you know, where do all these guys play in the meantime? I mean, you know, the guys that are in the real big leagues in Europe, I mean, that's pretty easy to track. But when does the national team there's a national team that usually is around for all these other tournaments, but that's not the same as the World Cup team. How do these things all interlink together? I mean, I don't know the answer to that. I'm not necessarily asking you or Jimmy, but I mean, where do they come from? Where does the guy in the guy on the Congo team must be playing someplace. Is it an African league?
That's easy, Chief. They, like baseball, like hockey, the international football leagues, the big leagues, have developmental leagues. They get these kids by the time they're 13. They know.
They get them by the time they're... So I did some legal work for FIFA when I was at Baker there in Chicago. And the feeder... Jimmy's exactly right. The feeder programs start in many cases. For example, in South America, they start when these kids are like 7 and 8. And they identify these kids that early they put them into these feeder clubs, and there's a huge, what I don't think we understand, and it's why our people have to go to Europe. We don't understand how to coach youth programs here. We just don't. Our youth soccer programs are terrible compared to what we see in Europe or South America. They start screening these kids and they start selecting, and it's a ruthless program, but they start selecting kids at 7, 8, 9, and they funnel them into these developmental programs. These clubs then, and it's an actual transfer payment system, these clubs then move these kids up into higher leagues. And as they move them up into higher leagues, there's an economic transfer that occurs from the higher league club to the lower league club. They literally pay a rental fee or a transfer fee to the lower club. And that continues as these guys move up into the higher leagues. So by the time the kid's a 14 or 15 year old, if he's good, he's been flagged and pushed into a program, and there may be two or three transfer payments behind him from one club to another.
We're starting to do a little bit of that here. I mean, the guy in my building, I'm always talking about Salvador, he's my link into what's going on in Mexico and other places, but his grandson, his daughter lives in Texas, and I guess the kid's pretty good. He's like 9, 10, 11, somewhere in there, and they drive during whenever the season is. I think they drive 200 miles to Dallas every weekend, where he plays 2-3 games, and in some higher level league than they can find in their own town.
So we do something like this in our Olympic development programs, and I speak from personal experience. Not that I was in one, but I had a kid that was in one. So recreational volleyball was played in the suburbs of Northern Virginia, where I lived for a while. And at the end of the season, they have their playoff tournament. And there's, you know, it's like 150 kids, you know, playing volleyball, but, you know, 10, 15 teams. And one of my kids was a really good natural athlete. He got, you know, my father was a tremendous natural
athlete. This kid has your genes, Lou. He's a star.
No, not my genes. He got his grandfather's genes, but he was a tremendous natural athlete. It was obvious. I mean, every coach that had him through high school said, "Yeah, this kid." Da da da. Anyway, he was one of the few kids in this league. So he's a 10-year-old, and he's serving overhand. He's dropping the ball in. He's moving around. So at the end of they go to play in the championship game, and they finish the tournament, and I see him being. His mother and I are sitting there, and we see these two men talking to him over in the corner, and they're just chatting with him. And I'm going, you know, you just sort of go, "What is this? I don't know these guys." So we go on over, and it was the funniest thing, Tom. I walk over. I said, "Hi, I'm his father. Everything okay?" And these two guys turn and look at me, and literally look at my feet. And the guy goes, looks at my from my feet to my head, and he turns and looks at the other guy and nods. And I felt like I was being like I was a side of beef.
Well, the kid's going to grow to your size.
That's exactly what it was. They said, "Do you have anybody in your family in your history over six three?" And I said, "Yeah, like a great grandfather." And they went, "Oh." And they've got a clipboard and they're writing this down.
Really?
They were U.S. Olympic volleyball development program scouts, and they tagged him, and he went into the Olympic development program for 3 or 4 years. So I got a taste of what this was like, but they literally handed me a clipboard and said, "Here's what we're doing. Can you give us a genetic history? Can you talk to us about what you know?"
What are they going to ask you if you're a sperm sample, for God's sake? Pretty close.
No, but they asked about genetic history. They asked about height. They asked about size. His brother was there, who was you know, over was growing, obviously going to be over 6 feet or over 6'1". They asked, you know, have any of your relatives played sports at a high level? And I said, well, his grandfather is in the College Football Hall of Fame. And they went, ah, you know. So we have that kind of scouting system. And the kids, I mean, it was remarkable when he went into this program. You watch these kids, you know, all of who have been scouted and selected, coming together from all over the place, and pumped into this program. And so this is happening all over the country with programs like volleyball. It happens with swimming, with U.S. swimming, but it's not the kind, you know, you and I, because we're traditionalists, tend to think of our colleges and our high schools as the feeder programs for these things, for these clubs. They're not.
This is kind of right up your alley, and I know you've thought about it. What's the downside to all this? I remember, you know, I remember stuff I read. I can't even tell you where I read it, but somehow or another, I'm cursed with remember what I read. I was reading this. This has to be 30 years ago when people were starting to split off where you didn't play two or three sports. You only played one.
Mm-hmm. We talked about this.
Well, we had to,
shortly after I started on the program.
Yeah, and I think the Tribune ran some big thing, and the guy's going, how detrimental this was to kids' long term health, and how when the muscles you use in basketball are different than the ones in football are different than the ones in baseball. So you essentially give a rest to your football muscles if you're playing something else in the spring, and when you start pushing kids into one sport only at age 12, you're doing them a physical, very big disservice. Anyway, but I one of the ladies who's been on the show, go nameless, was a serious volleyball player in high school and all those other things, AAU and everything. Well, she's on about her third shoulder surgery that none of the high schools are doing. I think she got a college ride. I don't know where, but none of those people were paying for. The lady who was at, somehow or another, our club over here lost their liquor license, so this group came in three nights a week, and they used theirs, like, essentially catered the bar. But anyway, but the guy's a real good guy, good softball player, and his wife, she's drop-dead gorgeous. She's one of the sweetest people you've ever met. You couldn't bear to watch her walk.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out she was a real serious cheerleader at some college. And I'm talking, she's 27, 28, already passed her third spine surgery. I think, you know, boy, I'm no female anatomy person. I'll tell you what, she probably could have had a baby. I don't see how she could ever have picked him up, or her. I mean, I don't know. I mean, her whole life, you know, do I need another surgery? Is this as good as I'm going to get? The entrails, the litter from all this stuff that people are doing, does anybody even keep track of this? Sports-related injuries that insurance companies are paying. What are we doing here?
I mean, this is the sort of the flip side. We want people to be active. We want people to you know, be physically capable. But at certain levels, when you train up for this, and if you don't train intelligently, and you train up for this, you're going to run the risk of injury. I mean, I played football. I played football, you know, into college. And I've got injuries from it. Although the most long-term injury I've ever had, I got playing softball of all things. But we want people to develop like this. The downsides of this kind of training are these kinds of, you can get hurt, which frankly is one of the big attractions of football to young men, is that it's a risky, risk-taking kind of venture. You can get hurt. You can get hurt long-term. There are other problems. I mean, a certain number of those kids that you start culling out are going to say at some point, I don't want to do this anymore. This isn't fun anymore. You take the joy out of it. Because if you train at a certain level and you're not enjoying training at that level, you say, I don't want to, I've had it. I have a very good friend whose kid was ranked in the top 10 gymnasts in 14 and 15 year olds in the United States. he was a tremendous talent. And at 15, he told his parents, "I'm sick of this. I don't want to do it anymore. I want to have a normal life. I don't want to be traveling every weekend. I don't want to, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I want to have a normal life." And he stopped cold turkey.
Well, you see these Olympic like figure skaters at 3 a.m. for 10 years. The mother's taking them to some ice when you're falling on your ass 10 times every morning. I mean, good Lord. Yeah.
Or I mean, you know, I swam with Olympians when I was in high school. I swam with two guys who went to the U.S. Olympic team, and the workouts that we went through with those guys, because I swam, you know, they were doing the same workouts that I was. So they were just doing them a lot faster. The workouts for that are my father, the professional coach, football coach, looked at me a couple of times and said, you got to be careful here, because you are wrung out with what you're doing to yourself in the pool in terms of working hard. Those workouts are just insane when you think about how hard those kids are swimming. And it's only gotten now. It hasn't gotten worse because we're getting a lot smarter about you know, short-term intense training. It used to be you just piled yardage or meters.
If some is good, more must be better. You know,
that's right. They don't do that anymore. It's a much more focused kind of training. So in that respect, we're getting smarter. But yeah, there are real disadvantages to this kind of stuff, and you have to be, if you've got a kid in one of these programs, you have to be cognizant of injuries. You have to be cognizant of their mental state. You have to be aware of you know, what kind of coaching they're getting. I was a little more aware than most because of my family background on this, but there are definite downsides. And as I said, these club programs with soccer and some of our Olympic sports are fairly ruthless. You know, it's a dog, and I mean, in the third world, you know, coming out of some of the places in South America, it's this is your way out. This is your ticket out.
Yeah.
And think about the motivation that promotes. If you are a talent coming out of a really hard life in some suburb of Rio de Janeiro, and you are your family's ticket out, you know.
Well, I mean, it's. I don't even want to say it, but in those kinds of, in those sort of areas of the world, if somebody has a bad knee from soccer, I don't think anybody gives two craps. But here we do, and we'll fix the guy's knee, and other people will pay for it. That's the problem I have with it. I mean, the high school is not going to pay for it. As George Conner once told me, Tom, I had 22 surgeries after football, and none of them were paid by Notre Dame and the Bears. Well, that's a problem to me. I want the guy to have his surgery and be able to walk because he's a real nice dude. But by the same token, is what they call it, it's like an externality. A guy named Ronald Coase coined this term. It's an economic externality, Lou.
Yeah, I'm familiar. I'm familiar with the concept.
You know what the original paper was on that? It had to do with like pollution and things like that. He wrote it. God, the guy died when he was like 98 or something. He wrote it probably 70 years ago, and it was a. This is the classic economic paper on what we're talking about, where a plant came into some little town in Scotland, and started a plant. You know, and the plant was kind of dirty, and he didn't go into the fact that people are getting lung cancer and dying. He based the whole thing on before that you had to whitewash your house and fence every 5 years, and after the place started belching smoke, people had to do it every 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, and who's responsible for that?
And so it's a cost of the place that they're able to put on other people. And you can tell I remembered the article, but it's so classic. Now, if you start asking people dying and stuff on top of it, then it gets much worse, obviously. But we never seem to have any of these. We never have anybody follow any of this stuff. I mean, once in a while, you know, have a company, you know, that, that helps clean up Love Canal because they poured the crap in there, or was the guys that made the outboard motors had to clean up Waukegan Harbor or something. But once in a while, you'll actually catch the knave. But in sports, I don't think anybody ever cares. I mean, my buddy Bill, is, you know, he's got good genes.
Well, it's economics, Tom.
Well, but it's always good at pushing stuff to other people. And that's what you got to keep your eye on, right?
Where there's money, and this again, this goes back to one of our themes. Where there's money, you will get the kind of focused attention on things like injury and repair and stuff like that, that keep the athlete, keep the machine working. Once the machine stops working and can't be repaired, or once there's no money coming in to give value to that machine, whether the machine is a pro athlete or a 9-year-old soccer phenom coming up out of someplace, where there's no longer money or there's no money supporting that, you don't get that kind of focus. And the advantage of this kind of ruthless club system, that the developmental system that I talked about, is that they monetize the athletic potential of 9, 10, 11-year-olds so that they're going to be taken care of. But they're taken care of in a context that to us seems foreign, because we think 9, 10, 11, 12-year-olds should be playing sports for fun. The FIFA, the Europeans, they don't look at it that way.
Oh no, they don't.
At least with respect to these programs,
they also don't blend it with their colleges at all.
Oh, they have no concept of our college sports. Every time a European comes to the United States and goes to like a college football game, they are absolutely stunned by this thing.
I mean, you were over there. You toured. Where'd you go? Were you in Oxford, or where'd you go? When I was playing, Cambridge.
Well, I've gone through the UK. I was at Cambridge, and then I spent a year in Italy.
Okay, but I mean, the guys in Cambridge, if you and I like to play soccer or any other sport, there's probably going to be a club team there and a club team at the college down the road. We'll still play, but it just won't be like Notre Dame playing Ohio State, right?
The only sport, or the main sport, where you see that kind of collegiate rivalry that I've ever seen it, is in rowing, and that's Cambridge versus Oxford on the Thames, and those contests are monstrous.
Really?
Yeah, those are huge. I've seen that they're less of a rugby, some contests in rugby and things like that, but there's the idea of these leagues and these conferences that we have that generate billions of dollars in revenue, so for on Saturday afternoons or Saturday evenings with basketball, the Europeans go, whoa.
Well, but I mean, there must be like a Cambridge rugby club or something.
There is, and they play against Oxford, and you get your blues against for participation against another school like that. That's a big deal, and they play, and they have a, you know, the Brits have their rugby union league and that plays, you know, national, international. Those games are there, but it's not like here.
I think our friend Andrew is coming on in a few minutes. I think he was a rower in the Ivy League. That was pretty intense. I think
it can get there.
We only got a few minutes. I've been looking at some of these guys, the new ships now that they're, we're talking about page two, and, you know, just the idea that, well, I guess I talked the other day about, you know, Trump all of a sudden buying millions of dollars worth of some stock that got this huge drone contract, but whatever. It's just the way he is, and everybody's going to justify how he should be able to do that. But by and large, how big is this drone thing getting, Lou, to the point where, how much of our stuff is now obsolete? Do we want smaller aircraft carriers? They just have 500 drones on there and maybe a few planes, or what do we want? It seems to me that this stuff is changing pretty fast.
So the drone business is going to be huge, and what you're moving to from relatively simple drones, which can create problems for you, and it's just a question now of, you know, it's like every other weapon system that gets introduced. You have your weapon, and then you have a counter, and then you have a counter-counter, and then you have a counter-counter-counter. We're in the process right now of developing counter systems to drones, and these simple, relatively cheap drones can be countered fairly readily. It takes focus, and it takes intensity, and it's not necessarily really glamorous stuff, but you can put air defense, short-range air defense systems in the form of machine guns or shotguns that can take down those systems. And we are developing, and I know the Chinese and the Russians are developing it too, developing autonomous systems that will sit and just monitor. And if they see a drone, they can shoot it down with a gun or with a cannon or a laser.
It's almost like flak, isn't it?
Yeah, it's exactly what it is. So that's one aspect of self-defense. And we're modifying our self-defense systems on our armored vehicles so that they can, because we have self-defense systems for these vehicles that can stop rocket-propelled grenades and anti-tank missiles and things like that. They can deal, and they'll be able to eventually deal with relatively slow-flying systems. The issue is saturation attack, and we're gonna have problems with that, and so will everybody else that decides to fight in this environment. This is one of the reasons why systems you want to have systems that are going to be survivable, that can manage against swarms, that can manage against you know, overwhelming kind of autonomous attacks from robot vehicles. And this was one of the reasons why the battleship may well be making a comeback, along with, you know, maybe smaller aviation platforms. I think aircraft carriers are going to be necessary into the near future, even though they are big targets. But the whole concept of the battleship that got floated, pardon the expression, what was it, 8 or 9 months ago, was that you could make this thing a legitimate gun platform that could screen, protect not only itself, because it's big enough to have the power generation and carry the magazine depth that it could defend itself, but it could defend a wide area of other vessels.
And we're not talking 16-inch guns, we're talking other kinds of guns.
We're talking rail guns, we're talking electronic warfare stuff, we're talking lasers, we're talking, you know, what have you. You know, missile. It would be effectively a long-range strike platform with missiles, because it'll have drones of its own.
But it wouldn't be. I mean, I toured the battleship New Jersey. One of the three gun things, which is six stories high, weighs more than a full destroyer, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you don't need that, I don't think.
Well, no. But you need something like that in terms of long-range strike power. Plus, you need a platform that can take hits from weapon systems that may be swarming at it, and defend itself against them, and defend other ships against them. So, you know, these kinds of platforms,
if somebody was going to design one today, given how fast this stuff's moving, how good of a job do you think they'd do? Or they'd make it so that it was, you could do a lot of things with it. It wouldn't be...
Well, So again, you know, moderation in all things. What you're looking for is a mix of forces. The Navy has moved, and so has the Air Force, for that matter, and the Army, has moved because of the targeting capability these systems have. We've moved into a concept called distributed lethality, which means you want to magnify the number of potential targets that can hit your opponent. You want to magnify those things and multiply them to an extent that it's much harder for the bad guys to target them. So you're talking about things like shipping containers. The Chinese are doing this right now. They have cruise missile launching capability from shipping containers that they
can
put on
transport ships. Isn't that what the Ukraine did to Russia?
Yes, something like that.
Didn't they ship the container like all the way across the country?
Yeah, they drove it on a truck, parked it outside an airbase. Same kind of concept. So So we're moving in that direction. And I see that our time is just about up.
What do you got going for the big weekend, the 250th?
I'm headed up into the mountains where it's cool, although it's smoky. We got big fires here.
Boy, this summer is getting nasty here. We went from 70 to 95 without stopping at 80.
And there's more on the way because it's really hot here, and you guys will get it here shortly. So you guys have a terrific fourth, okay?
Thank you for that, Lou. Thank you for that prediction. I was hoping it was going to be cooler. Oh, here you go. Thanks, bud. Have a nice weekend. Do we have our guys?
Good morning.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What a fascinating segment. You covered the world. I don't know what there's left to say.
Well, I had you as being a serious roar in the Ivy League going down the river.
Well, I heard that part. And I see Wayne is here, but and we're.
I am, and I'll have you know that Andy did yeoman's work the other day. He attended the quote unquote Great American State Fair on the Washington Mall, and his attendance there doubled the number of people that they actually had.
Well, there you go. How hot was that? Is Washington as bad as it is here?
It was bad, but you know, you look at the temperatures around the country, and you got listeners in Arizona, and if they're the ones suffering.
Yeah, I remember once reading that when the New Deal, Roosevelt was having so much. I don't know which parts of the New Deal that they called a session back in the summer. And just before anybody had air conditioning, and they actually were meeting, Congress was meeting outside, and finally people got so tired of being there, they just signed it and left. They passed laws they probably never would have if there had been air conditioning. Is that remotely true? I can't imagine what Washington must have been like back then.
I seem to recall that story. And speaking of Roosevelt, we all saw Donald Trump yesterday at the new Theodore Roosevelt Library in North Dakota, was actually conversing with an AI image of Teddy Roosevelt and lambasting the Democrats for giving back the Panama Canal. Of course, this AI version of Roosevelt, it's programmed to answer questions about his administration and things personal to him. One step above, you know, the animatronic presidents at Disneyland. But this conversation he was having with Teddy Roosevelt was picked up by the media, and further questions about his mental fitness.
Well, when he said his new plane couldn't build such a thing, yet it was built here. It's a Boeing plane. I'm like, what are you talking about? It's built here, you idiot. I mean, we could never do this here. We could never build anything like this here. What are you talking about? It was built here.
You know, there's a throne for the Emir Qatar on that aircraft. And the question is that throne still there, and is he sitting in it?
Oh, God. Well, a lot of what... everybody keeps talking about this blue wave. I honestly don't see it. He's planning on having or thinking about some huge, get out the rally type of thing in September in Dallas. I don't think that's going to help him. I think he just. You guys don't know what I'm asking. I'm asking the question. I'm not. When you look through the numbers, I don't see any blue wave. I mean, they might be. Because you know people don't change these guys as often as you think. I don't know. I what do you think? I think it's pretty close call in both places.
I was a young poli sci student back in 1974. This was, of course, the same year Nixon resigned. Remember, he resigned in August, and we had the general election, of course, in November that year. And I'm recalling some of the same dynamics. Nixon's popularity when he resigned was 22%. Trump hasn't gone there yet, but his popularity is on that projection. It's around 30-31 right now. If you don't listen to the pollsters who are getting paid by Rupert Murdoch's organization, but okay. So in 74, the Republicans got hammered across the board, and they didn't call it a blue wave, but a whole bunch of Democrats, including a lot of younger people who had very little experience in politics, were elected to the House, not so much the Senate, but it was called the Class of 74. I'm thinking we're seeing the same dynamic play out here. So the House, I think, will go Republican, and the Senate...
you mean Democrat, don't you?
Yeah, I'm sorry. The House will go Democrat, and the Senate is going to be close, but the Democrats could wind up with a, 2-3 majority there.
What is a... What exactly is the Democratic platform, other than they don't like Trump? I mean, I'm trying to be critical of both sides, because it's hard for me to. I don't get how people have to be so one side or the other. To me, it's just, if I see something I don't like, I don't care which side it is. But what exactly is there a Democratic platform? I don't think there's. Well, there's a Trump platform, which I think is disgusting. But I don't know that. I actually listened to I'm all over the place here. I listened to a YouTube thing the other day of a gentleman who's been a Republican his whole life. It doesn't make him bad by any stretch. And he goes, what we really need, we need to get a center-right, make-sense party like the Republican Party used to be. We don't have that now. We have this void. He goes, the Democrats do too, but he goes, I'm not worried about them. He goes, the Republicans, we need to get our party back.
Well, let me jump in.
Yeah,
I try to follow that pretty closely. I think you cannot have a Democratic platform because there's no elected nationwide leader. There's so what's the strategists, the best strategists, I think, say is get excellent local candidates with bios that resonate with their locality and unify behind the local and regional candidates who are adaptable to their district. And that's why I think your question arises, because as people sort through these different victories or momentums, trying to find a common thread. The common thread is who's relevant and popular in their area. So the people who won in the New York primaries, the so-called Democratic Socialists, well, actually, they're not the candidates who are being nominated in South Carolina, Ohio, and elsewhere. And, you know, they won there. They're not really socialists. Socialists, Paul Krugman this morning had a column, socialists is owning the means of production. Nobody is really advocating that who's running for office. There's no one, not even the Democratic Socialists. But I think that's my attempt to answer your question. If Pelosi, who's still in office, announced a nationwide Democratic platform, or even if the head of the DNC, all it would do is create a self-destructive controversy. So,
when you talk about... By the way, that was going to be my biggest theme this morning with you guys, is that when we flip these terms around, and anybody, matter of fact, some of my Notre Dame guys were, that are on the right. I'm not talking about Kevin, all the other guys. Anybody who somehow doesn't adhere to what they think is this current capitalist system, which, by the way, isn't really capitalism. It's something. it is automatically a communist or a socialist. And that's just not true. The people who are calling somebody a socialist probably can't even define the term. And as you kind of alluded to, Andrew, the people running a socialist probably can't even define the term. I mean, it's what do these terms even mean? I mean, I find it very similar, and again, I'll be happy to take an F paper if you guys say it is, to my reading of the Depression. People were very much questioning our economic system. Because, by the way, it sucked. We had a depression going on, right? And, I mean, I think the three of us and a lot of the listeners know that there was a lot of mistakes that were made and things that happened that caused the recession that wasn't really a fault of, quote, our system, and that our system would find a way out of it. But by and large, anybody who questions this plutocracy we've become, where some people have, seem to have all the money, they also were buying the newspapers. I mean, anybody who thinks this is wrong, which I do, I am no more a socialist economist than the man on the moon. I spent 20 years on the trading floor. How does that make me a communist, for God's sake? Or one guy owning all the trades. I don't want any of that stuff. But I don't even think the people who lob this stuff out on a daily basis, they can't even define what... If you don't like the fact that Elon Musk has got nothing but money from the government and now controls too damn much, all of a sudden I'm a communist? No, I'm not. I just don't like what's happened. I mean, I'm stopping talking. You guys, what am I even saying here?
Well, there is a term, social democrat, but what that means politically is, programs like we think of as from Sweden or Denmark or, where there's a social safety net, but that's not socialism. That's a social democracy where, healthcare is more affordable and so forth. But to go to this communist idea, here's one thing we see in the news, is that's become the term to just brand anyone from the Trump administration. They brand anyone they don't like as a communist. Well, what's an actual kind of communist and socialist government in the world? Well, it's our new friends in Venezuela.
Yeah.
And, however they're defined, socialist, communist, we suddenly like them. We arrested their leader, Maduro, but we left his number two in charge, and we're kind of, the Trump administration, and by inference the U.S., we're fighting to maintain that regime, and that's an actual socialist regime.
And we have the president right now demanding a piece of the action from various mostly high-tech and AI companies. He wants, 10%. And that's not the government he's representing. That's himself. And
why can't people see that?
It's beyond me. That's not even that's corrupt. Basically, small C communists, really, it's kleptocracy.
It's a cross between kleptocracy and fascism of some kind.
And we saw that, of course. That was in fascists. And Mussolini, he's the one who came up with the idea of corporate fascism, where he and the select monopolies would control the country. That was picked up by Franco in Spain later, and Pinochet eventually in Chile. So... it seems like that's the system that Trump is adopting. And as you said from the outset, that's nothing like the Republican Party of even Mitt Romney, closer to the present day. Certainly even Mitt Romney
define a system where you push a drone contract to a company and the president buys $1 to $5 million worth of stock 2 weeks before they get the contract? How do you even define that? But here's my question on a personal level. Besides, hey, Andrew, I got something I need to tell you. We can do if you want. don't let me stop without saying that. But what is it about the current world that I don't quite understand? Maybe it's just my Irish Catholic background. I don't know. But when Hillary and everybody on the show who's from the right assumes I'm this flaming liberal Democrat. I mean, I'm not. Hillary got caught with her fingers in the pie in the commodity firm in Arkansas that was making trades and putting the winners in her account and the losers in other people's account. And the minute I heard that, I said, you know what? Because that's my business. I don't care that she's from Park Ridge. I don't care that she's a Democrat. I'm never voting for her in my life, and I never have. I mean, why? It was not my job. I mean, some people seem to think on the show, people I know, best friends, seem to think it's their job to dig back in history and find some Republican scumbag that did the same thing, which I'm sure you could find somebody who got Goldman Sachs or somebody put trades in their account that wasn't theirs. And somehow the conclusion is it's okay because I found a Republican that did the same thing, so she's off the hook. And I'm thinking, how? But now every time something amazingly obvious of what a crook this guy is, it's somebody's obligation to go back and say, oh man, look what Hunter did, or look what Pelosi did. Why does anybody even think like that? I mean,
well, gee, I should be more coherent because I was jumping in here. But actually, Wayne and I do that all the time. I think it's important to look at both the specific corruption, whoever it is, and get to the bottom of it, but also place it in a relative context. And I think that's what Wayne and I try to do multiple times a day, multiple scandals, and we continue that process. And it's not all the same, but the motivation is, yeah, you got to go after corrupt people, whoever they are. And I've never talked about it on the show, but someday I will, that I'm actually litigating against a corrupt person. We'll talk about it when we get the resolution. But yeah, you want to expose the facts, but it's got to be put into an overall context. And maybe my last and most important point on this is we see, and Wayne and I, because we focus on this, but you probably see that, and your listeners, our listeners, also see that there are some people who really, their motivation is to get information to advance their side's interest. And they have literally no interest in any information about corruption or anything else that hurts their side. And that's a problem, because how can you talk to people who are only trying to get information that bolsters their party, their religious denomination, or their personal family, or whatever?
I would just add, Chief, I'm with you on Hillary Clinton. I've never been a big fan of hers. It's funny you mention it, because I was talking to Andy yesterday, and we have Hillary Clinton now saying that she agrees with this Trump Board of Peace that he announced. They're operating out of the former U.S. Institute of Peace, now the Trump Institute of Peace. Anyway, this is the advisory body that's supposed to be governing Gaza. She was pressed on this thing where she said, yeah, I think this is a good idea. It's the one thing that I agree with Trump on. And they pressed her on it. She said, well, Tony Blair, who's on this advisory committee over Gaza, he asked me to endorse it because it's a personal favor I'm doing for Tony Blair. Well, Tony Blair is still one of the most corrupt prime ministers that England has, or UK has seen in recent memory. And for her to say, well, you know, it's a tit for tat type thing where, you know, I mean, it just shows the corruption of both of them.
How does, I mean, we always talk with you guys because I love picking your brain, to be honest with you. My uncle was a pretty smart guy. He talked about Richard Daley I, the dumb mayor. And he said, you know, Chicago is fine because the corruption is at a level that everybody pretty much is okay with, and it's not out of control, and but he never said there was none. But there was almost like the, I don't know if it's the World War II generation, maybe they all were in the army and came back or whatever, I don't know what caused it, but there seemed to be a general idea, and again, this is, you know, going back when I was younger, there seemed to be a general idea of kind of what was okay and what wasn't. I mean, if Uncle Charlie needed a job and you went to the alderman and you got, you know, a job opening a bridge at night or something, which nobody really wants, and you went and worked the precinct for him in the election, I guess if you're a purist, there's something wrong there. But on a personal level, you go, that's kind of okay. But if somebody were to say, like some of the aldermen now demand, you need to give me two jobs, and the guy's not even going to show up. Now, most people of that era would say, what do you mean? The guy doesn't have to show up. I mean, the guy's supposed to show up and do a good job. That's part of the deal. I mean, somehow or another, we seem to have lost this collective idea of what's reasonable and what isn't. I mean, I think the stuff Trump's doing with the stock and the trading is so far unreasonable, makes Hillary look like a kid. But I look at people and they go, oh, everybody does that. I mean, I look at Hunter. No, they don't. And if they do, I want them in the jail right next to them. I mean, am I just too old here or what? I mean,
One of the things that's happened is he's deliberately, to the extent he's cognizant, normalizing corruption so that it's not news anymore. And in fact, the historian Heather Cox Richardson, in her column this morning, wrote about this plane that he flew yesterday to North Dakota. And the point of her column as a historian, she said, we cannot normalize this. It's in the Constitution. You're not supposed to get gifts from foreign countries. And here's this Cotter gives him $400 billion airplane that he plans to keep if he ever leaves office, and it's right there in the Constitution. And we've got to remind ourselves that even though we knew about it months ago, that this is still news.
Lou's used the term moral relativism. I read something yesterday about this birthright thing that came out of the Supreme Court. And the guy quotes the line in the 14th Amendment, which is part of the Constitution, right, an amendment. He quotes the line, everybody born here is a natural-born citizen. He goes, what's the debate? I mean, if you want to get another amendment to change it, I guess you could do that. But how does a Clarence Thomas go, well, that was for a reason, and I'm in those guys' minds, and it's really not the reason today. And people, it says right there. I can think of, if you were to do it all over again today, maybe you do it slightly differently. That's not the job of these. It says right there, right?
Here's a quick little debate in constitutional circles on this. Most people, constitutional scholars or the man in the street, I think, totally agrees with you. But the legal profession has people who's, you know, make a living saying yes, but, and I've got a different view, and they get a certain prominence and maybe making money or so forth. So the argument by Thomas and those who agreed with him is, well, there might be some extraordinary situations. Suppose you had somebody that you knew was only coming here to have a baby, and they shouldn't be allowed to take advantage of it. And we've got to have a factual determination. If you knew that they weren't really intending to be domiciled, which is the term, domiciled, here. But, yeah, that's a theoretical point. You could even call it an ivory tower type of stupidity point. But it satisfies a mega base, and it confuses the issue. But common sense says, look, we're going to have a trial on every disputed immigrant who has a baby. Who's going to have a trial? What court?
Plus, what rights does a baby, if the mother gets sent back, what rights does the baby have here? None.
Yeah, and they send the mother to the Congo when she's actually from Mexico. And we're supposed to have a trial? Who's paying for that? So it's exactly the type of kind of ivory tower stupidity that Thomas was raising. And by the way, he is not only a Yale Law School graduate, but when I was on a committee inviting speakers to the Yale Law School alumni dinner, I think I was the first one to recommend that he be invited to speak at our dinner. Because I thought it'd be interesting to see what he has to say, meet him, so forth. But this is the inanity that gives lawyers and professors, brings forth ridicule, and yet he's supposed to be the man of the people. It's a convoluted game, but
I don't think that guy was ever a man of the people. I don't know. People think Trump's a man of the people.
Well, the story of him and his RV that he liked to travel around, and even his book about his grandfather, that was a phony book deal where he got paid a lot of money to make up lies and a phony story about how great his grandfather was and a nice influence. So we kind of see through it, but it works in the mass media in many ways.
It's a I'm going to say, Andrew, though, and I know you guys talk to as many young people. There's a massive difference in mentality, though, in a lot of people. I'm not saying just young, but maybe it's I'll use the term brainwashing that they get from the press. If they don't think something fits, whether it's been immoral for 9 zillion years. You can't go by that today. What do you mean? Well, everybody steals, so you get to steal. No. Everybody goes through. You don't mind if I ask Andrew here kind of a law question, Wayne? But I was in the Illinois Constitution. In there, there's a line that says you can't diminish anybody's pension once they get it. Now, I think if I was Clarence Thomas, I would say that was in there because you don't want the governor to threaten to cut the judge's pension if they don't do what he says or something like that. So I can see that sort of reason behind it. But I also know it's been expanded to where if you cheat and once you get a pension, even if you didn't deserve it, they can't take it away from you. It's been expanded to a huge. But I read this legal argument where somebody said that thing, even though it's in the Constitution, this is another attorney talking, you should be able to beat that in court because it doesn't say who has to pay for it. You can say you have to that everybody deserves their pension, but if all of a sudden someday the state's broke, who writes the check? They said it's missing something. it's one thing to say you can never not pay somebody. It's quite another to say who pays for it if the person who's supposed to can't. And it was very interesting. I'm sitting there, the guy made some pretty good points, but am I just being one of the knuckleheads now? The guy's basically saying it's like saying a state can't go bankrupt. Okay, but they can go broke. What's the difference? I mean, it, you know what I'm saying? If you don't define where the money's coming from, it's like if you had an amendment in the Constitution said, you know, people can never die. Okay, it's a fine line, but what good does it do?
Well, a couple quick thoughts. One, this is why you want to have basically honest, fair-minded judges interpreting these things. And there was a longtime professor at the University of Chicago Law School, Cass Sunstein, now teaching at Harvard. And one of his favorite analogies about the confusing interpretation problems judges face is, suppose there's a law that says no guns in the park, and some idiot says, well, I'm suing on this basis because there's a Civil War cannon in the park and we have to have it removed. The law says no guns in the park. Get rid of the Civil War monument. So people got to bring some common sense to this stuff. But in terms of pensions, we know why they put these concepts in. There's a legislative history. But if you have partisan or corrupt judges, they're always going to find a way around it. And one of the things Wayne has been educating me on, Wayne's, of course, a Navy veteran intelligence officer, and very early on, I think a couple of years ago, Wayne was educating me about how if you have a corrupt military apparatus, they can call back retired military to active duty and punish them. And maybe Wayne can amplify on that.
You know, that's what they're threatening Senator Kelly with. Hegseth was saying, we'll call you back to court-martialing and bust you down to whatever, you know.
And so, theoretically, that shouldn't be. Somebody rises and serves for many years, and then because you don't like something that they said on a radio show, you call them back to active service and you treat them like they're a private and punish them as if they're in the military command. And Wayne, can that affect pensions or not?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. With Senator Kelly, they had court-martialed, found guilty. They could have busted him down in rank, say, from to a Navy, say, one rank, but then he would get the retirement of that lower rank instead of what he is. He's a retired captain.
And, of course, a senator from Arizona and an astronaut and all kinds of things. But they didn't like what he said.
How does this population put up with this big Pete Hegseth? I don't know if I've ever seen anybody in my mind more disgusting in my life. I don't know. I mean, at that level, and he's proud of it. It's not like he does it behind the scenes.
Yeah. He was thrown out of the military because of the National Guard because of his far right activities. So, in many respects, this is his revenge tour.
That's interesting. It's kind of a so what. What is the election gets closer? What are the hot button issues? I don't want to beat up on it, but this whole idea of communist, socialist, capitalist. I think that we need to get together for like a week in adult beverages. I'm trying to find out to define what we have now. What do we have now? What is this? I mean, I guess if you made money, you think it's great capitalism. If you got the right stock or whatever, but if you don't, if you see the inflation, I don't think I ran this by you guys last week. The numbers, and I've done it with everybody, so I'll be brief. As you know, to ad nauseum, I think a lot of social problems are because of economic problems. I mean, I think that's been history since people hit stones, and I see that the we have a new Fed chairman who's jumping up and down about he's really going to control inflation, meanwhile he's doing nothing in my mind. But in the last 6 years, money supply is up 48%, which most economists, at least ones over the age of 40, would say you better be looking around for a 40% inflation. The admitted inflation is 28%. And oh, by the way, the average wage growth is 21%. And I think contained in those three numbers is a lot of the partisan bickering you're seeing right now. Because, I mean, people have the feeling that the only way that you get ahead is by cheating. Or if you own stocks. I mean, 39% of the population owns stocks. I mean, Trump said that yesterday. If you own stocks, what are you worried about? Because he owns stocks. He goes, I made a lot of money because I own stocks. Look at the stock market. Everybody should be happy. Well,
that's not how he made his money, I don't think.
No, but I'm saying, but his point is, the other 61% of the people I don't really give a crap about, is what he's saying.
Yep. And,
but, I mean, I think those numbers contain a lot of, I don't know if you guys get a chance to listen on Wednesday, she has been on a week or so, but Larissa was talking about how she studies a lot of, because she teaches us at Purdue, even the K-shaped recovery, you know, where one group is going a lot faster than the other, she goes, the bottom half of the top K is now starting to break down. That even, quote, the suburbanites aren't keeping up. The people that are making the 175 grand a year where you think everything's fine, even they can't afford the new insurance costs, the new roof, the new car, and by the way, college education. They can't keep up. So it's only now your top maybe 10% that's fat and happy, and it's not the bottom 60, it's getting to be like the bottom 75. Is what she's seeing. I don't know if you guys want to comment on that, but I think a lot of what you see is mudslinging as who's at fault. You know, is if you're from the Democratic side, it's the plutocracy we're talking about, or kleptocracy or whatever. I mean, if you're on the top side, it's all these immigrants we spent all this money on. I mean, everybody's pointing a finger at somebody else. I think the reason why they're pointing is because they themselves don't feel they're gaining. Am I wrong or right? But test me here.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's grievance is the national hobby that, and we all encounter it in our life. With people who feel deeply aggrieved almost no matter what their situation is. So people want to play into that. People want to be a victim. And meanwhile, who's populating the den mothers and Boy Scout leaders and people building communities? I mean,
I think though, Andrew, that the reason why they feel aggrieved is because they are.
Well, yeah, but and pointing fingers at other people is a way to solve it psychically from a personal basis, but it doesn't solve the political problem. And if I could go back to one of the things that you said before about World War II, I spent time as a young man, a kid actually, in Arkansas when my grandparents from Chicago retired to the Ozarks. And this was in the late 50s, early 60s. And one of the things I recall my grandparents saying is that, of course, Arkansas was still segregated then, racially.
Oh, God, yeah.
But they'd say, you know, one of the things that's changing around here is that you have black World War II veterans coming out of the Army in the 40s and coming back to places like Arkansas. And at some point, they're not putting up with the old system. And that's kind of a bond that people had that's not by... that's one aspect of it. But you were talking more generally about a common bond. But there's nothing like having a full mobilization of the population to fight the fascists. No wonder they had common ground.
Well, I mean, there's a I think most people, even though you'd like everybody to be pure, we're not pure. We're humans. I mean, if the three of us are selling PT boat engines and somehow we charge 5% more, but by the way, we hire all the people in the neighborhood, we drink at the local bar, I guess it's, you know, it's not okay, but it's okay. It's manageable. Everybody knows what but if you start to get an Elon Musk guy where everybody who's now paying 80 grand, I don't know if they're doing much anymore, but paying 80 grand for a pickup truck, and Musk gets a check because you bought a gas-covered pickup truck, most people are going to say, where does that come from? I mean, it's... Hey, real quick, when Andrew, I know you're a Chicago native. Mr. Flanagan, who comes on Monday, is a real genius on family history because he used to work for the Census Bureau in his part-time stuff. And why are census records held up for 70 years? I mean, if it was 60, would there be a big change in what we do to people? I mean, he just got me census records for my family from, like, 1950. That's the latest one.
Well, he'd be the expert on that, but it might have to do with privacy concerns, but that's just speculation on my part.
Well, would you like to see the addresses that your family, your Chicago side of the family, lived in, like, before they moved to Oak Lawn?
Oh, yeah.
He can get all that for you.
That sounds like a great resource.
Yeah, he actually dug up the obituary for the original Thomas Howe that died in an electrical thing, like 6 months after he got married. He found me the wedding thing, he found me the obituary, and the death notice.
God, Chief, you had me worried. I thought you were going to say the electric chair.
No, well, maybe, but I don't think there was any workman's comp, and that's, and it was, this was, we're talking 1907. I don't think there was any workman's comp on that. Not 1907, probably somewhere in the 1920s. It's so I mean,
I was just going to say, I occasionally indulge with great enjoyment in looking back at, you know, obviously my own family history, but the larger patterns. And my grandfather wrote a book about his life and times. Let me think what the title was. It was, you know, really for his own family, but it was In Search of Love and Money, about old Chicago. And it was just fascinating. For one thing, he worked at this real estate office downtown, and there was a rule that you couldn't date, much less marry, anybody in the company. And it was a small company. And he secretly married my grandmother. And people would come to him with dating advice, saying, "Gee, I'd really like to go out with her. Do you think you could help me?" It was his wife.
Well, guys, we got to dash because these numbers are coming up here. Well, what do you guys got planned for the weekend? Anything big? There's got to be some massive fireworks and stuff in Washington, I would think.
Oh, there is, but Trump is planning a 90-minute speech before the fireworks. So currently, the fireworks, partly because of the heat here, are not scheduled to go off to 11 o'clock. Maybe they'll change it, but the problem is he wants a huge audience, and he's fighting both the heat and the idea that, are people really going to stick around till 11 o'clock?
You hear the same stuff over and over again?
Yeah.
I'll be watching that stuff.
Is that tomorrow or Saturday?
I think it's probably, I'm not sure, I should check, but it's probably the 4th.
Probably is. All right, guys, take care. These numbers are coming out in a second.
Have a good 4th.
You too, guys. SP Futures up 9, NASDAQ is up 62. These numbers, we have Professor Carl?
You certainly do.
We just ran up the numbers. Somebody must have them, Carl. The numbers, S&P's just ran up 15 points and the NASDAQ up 200. You don't think anybody gets these things early, do you?
Oh, you mean like the president?
Yeah, well, we used to have presidents.
You know, well, by the way, you know, in addition to what we know he did to all the people that bought his little meme coins, oh, by the way, if you happen to be the person who founds a cryptocurrency, you also get all the transaction fees.
Really?
Which in the case of his meme coin was a couple hundred million dollars. That's, of course, they're yours because you're the one that runs the exchange. So that's always very pleasant, right?
We made like $70 million on settlements from like media people. Now, when he did that,
well,
was his.
Well, yeah, but I mean, like, you know, all that stuff. All right, now here's. To put a little more of an economic spin on this, it doesn't have anything necessarily to do with the president. The other thing I saw on CNBC this morning, I got up while I was waiting for you guys and the numbers, which I think just dropped. Let me see if I can get the refresh on this.
I got the June. Yep.
Okay. Oh, plus 57. Okay, that let's see the and of course the all right. So the move is fairly muted. But this is probably people think, oh, no, no, they won't raise rates. Oh, yes, they will. Plus 57, see, 4.2 on that. So the irony is that's actually down a tick for the unemployment, the formal unemployment rate. Let me go ahead and, like, blow
you know, I'm gonna, you know what, I'm going to go through the A1. The blithering idiot.
Well,
one.
that's where I'm headed. Yeah, because I got the PDF file, and now I got to, you know, page down far enough to get.
All right,
to
the, well, I'm looking. Numbers. This is the household survey. I got
right.
This, what the hell? I got 500,000 less people working. I've got.
Well, hang on.
I got 700,000. Yeah. But here's the weird one. I've got the unemployment people unemployed, meaning looking for work. Down 300,000. That's where you get the 4.2 and the unemployment rate. I've got the people that we don't know what they're doing up like a million, 900,000.
Well, careful here because I'm. Looking
I'm just reading
the
numbers. I know. These are adjusted somehow.
No. I'm looking at the unadjusted, and I got 162,722 employed against 162,897 last month. And I'm 104,968 on NILF, which is, you know, the I'm playing with myself on the couch number.
But so the total amount of people, that aren't working,
well,
is up almost.
Well, 175, Chief, is the headline change on the household survey, unadjusted again, of course.
It's how much negative
that I care about. Neg 175.
All right, it's minus 500 adjusted.
Well, but you know.
Yeah. Okay. I'm just saying. Let that out there.
So there's a couple things you have to be a little bit careful with. Last night, myself and a lovely lady watched U.S. win its soccer match in the United States. How many people got hired to make sure those people had beer?
I heard the number this morning is like 40,000.
Well, but it's not zero, right?
Right.
And I mean, and those matches are going on all over the place. By the way, anybody that thinks that red card was called for has rocks in their head. So, you know, maybe we've got a little bias. But the thing is that you have to be careful a little bit with some of these numbers because that's in there, all right? Because, you know, I mean, they're real jobs, right?
But Carl, how come?
But they're
how
not.
Come, I mean,
but,
I saw the article.
Not hold. Well, but Chief, but they're not going to hold. That's
no, okay.
Point.
I'm saying I saw the article. I know right where you're coming from, and I assumed you would bring it up because you always read this stuff. Why don't we ever? I'm not saying we should. Why don't we ever say? Come May, or actually April, well, we're now going to have, you know, 15 baseball parks playing every day, and there's 40,000 people that are working in those places, or 20, or whatever it is.
Well, because every year there's going to be baseball parks.
Okay, all right, fair enough. Yeah.
My point is simply that this is a one-off that doesn't happen on a. I mean, this is why I use the annualized numbers generally because Christmas always comes in December.
Well, I guess so. I mean, you're always Mr. Detail, so I'm always gonna, I love quizzing you on it. Why? Okay, so some of these games have been at SoFi, right, where they have the Rams and the Chargers play there.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So on a Sunday, there's going to be. How many people come to work at a football game? I'm probably playing 5,000-6,000 by the time you get the beer and all the hot dogs and all the other kinds of stuff.
Well, yeah.
But
yeah.
How How is that counted on a normal week? Those people, what's the difference between an NFL game there and a soccer game there? The same people, it's one day.
Well, that is a fair, you know, a fair question. The reason that I say that we have to be a little careful this year with the summer stuff is that the soccer stuff really is a one-off that's in the United States this time and normally is not. Okay. Right. Now, it's not entirely in the United States because, you know, they had a game in Toronto and, you know, but the majority of them are taking place in U.S. venues. So, and they're all over the place, okay? There's a bunch. You know, I mean, now you're, you know, round of 32 knockout, then you got round of 16. You know, kind of like the, you know, what happens with basketball, right, of this. But every year, your college sports take place. Every year, your professional sports that are U.S.-based take place.
All right.
They happen at the same time every year. Is not that.
You got to answer the basic question here. I'm a money manager all week. All of a sudden on Sunday, I got a hair up my behind. This year, I'm going to go serve hot dogs at the Bear games. Now, there's 9 games. Where am I counted? I'm counted nowhere. I'm not a full-time employee there. What am I?
You're not a full-time employee, but you're going to be in the household survey, and you're also in that case because that is certainly an above the table, above the line, everyone pays their taxes job. You're going to be in the establishment survey or whatever. Now, it's probably a contract house, but whatever entity hired you that, you know, leased you out to the stadium or whatever.
I'm only working 6 hours.
By the way, the internals on the educational attainment table, you know, that one that I love to look at all the time.
Yep.
And, you know, and point out, the numbers in there are absolutely abhorrent. This is horrible. Okay, now these are NSA numbers, not seasonally adjusted. Among those with less than a high school diploma, the employment population ratio was down 8 ticks.
That's a lot.
All right.
That's a lot.
That's a number. Yeah, hello, 42.9 to 42.1. For those people, now remember, what happens is around this time of year, people graduate, right? So you move up that ladder. You go from less than a high school diploma. And in fact, you see this, right? So that is, you know, that is real. But now here's high school graduates, no college. So when you move up, you drop into that bucket, right? Okay, that is down 5 ticks, 54.6 to 54.1. Now this is just month on month, all right? That ain't a good number. Some college or associates down from 59.3 to 58.8. All right, so this is rolling forward through educational attainment. And at the top is bachelor's or better from 69.8 to 69.1. So that's down 7 ticks. Now, that's, and by the way, in that group, the employed number went down from 65.5 million to 64.491. So these are real drops. These are large drops.
Well, that would probably, it probably shows why this, we don't know what they're doing, numbers so high.
Well, and by the way, it does. And where's that coming from? It is coming from the bottom two buckets because the unemployment rate among the less than high school diploma and the high school graduates, the unemployment rate among those two cohorts went down, whereas among the associate's degree and better, the formal unemployment rate went up.
Well, those that have been listening to the show for however long I've been doing this, like 20 years, always think I'm a goofball when I say this. Unemployment rate is the dumbest statistic in all of economics. And I was told that by Notre Dame professor on my second day in economics class.
Oh yeah. But you know what? But everybody loves to use it. So,
but I mean, anybody who thinks that there's 900,000 people that are not, we don't know what they're doing, they're not working, that actually less people out of the 900,000 are looking for work than last month is out of their friggin' mind.
Well, yeah, and one of the things that I have pointed out repeatedly is that if we've got this, we now have this thing with the TPS that just got terminated, and you have DeWine and other people down and around the Springfield area screaming that, oh my God, all these people are going to get deported, you know, it's going to destroy the, you know, industry down there and everything else. Okay, the facts are that Dole, which of course is a nice agricultural company, right, and that's what they do.
Oh, yeah.
Before those Haitians were all given TPS in here, they were paying Americans about $21 an hour, and as soon as they got the 20,000 Haitians dumped in there, who all immediately had, because of their TPS status, had immediate access to government benefits. So they all had Section 8 housing vouchers. They all had their medical care paid for. They all had SNAP. All of them on day one, not sometime later.
What do you mean medical care paid for? Nobody gets their medical care paid for.
No, they got Medicaid as immediately as TPS recipients. So they had health insurance, quote unquote health coverage. They had SNAP, and they had Section 8 vouchers. So two things instantly happened. Dole fired all the Americans. They're paying the Haitians $15 an hour, which they can get away with because the Haitian doesn't have to pay for his own housing. Okay, you're paying it by force. You're having a gun shoved in your face and forced because the federal government's issuing those Section 8 vouchers and the SNAP benefits. So the median rent in the county, in that immediate area, went from about $850 a month to $1,250. And at the same time, the wages that Dole was paying went from $21 an hour to $15. Now, if you're an American, you just got it in both holes.
Dole was a philanthropic operation in Cuba, too, weren't they?
Oh, yeah. Everybody's philanthropic when we can steal from somebody, right?
Their big thing is in Hawaii, right?
Well, you'd think. You know, the irony of this is that years and years ago, it's got to be almost 30 years ago now. I was in Hawaii, all right? And you would think that would be the cheapest place on the planet to get a pineapple, right? I mean, that's what you'd think, all right? You'd be wrong.
God.
You'd be very wrong. I was shocked. The pineapple in the store over there was like close to double what the same pineapple cost me at the grocery store in the United States. I was floored that this was the case, but it was. Oh, by the way, all right, so here's another interesting thing. So, you know, I frequently look at, okay, in terms of like reality, let's look at average weekly earnings, okay, across categories, because that's broken out fairly strongly. And what that picks up ahead of everything else, when you look at the average hourly earnings, is are people having hours cut, right? Because if my hourly earnings are going up but my paycheck's going down, obviously my hours are getting cut. It's not very hard to see. So here is where the sort of the interesting thing is. Leisure and hospitality, which of course would pick up all those people handing out beers at the FIFA games, their average weekly earnings were down, and yet their average hourly earnings went from $23.58 to $23.62. So their average your hourly pay was up, but your average check is down. That's not a good sign, especially when you have this artificial demand spike that's in there. Everybody else, just quickly scanning this thing, looks like it's, well, let's see, no, professional business services, average check is down, but average hourly earnings up a little bit. So professional business services does not look like it's doing so great either.
Well, Carl, if you could, I don't know why I'm on a kind of a basic kick today.
By the way, transportation warehousing has got the same pattern. There is a substantial amount of internal softness in this report, Chief.
Just as a way of, I don't know, I guess people might be interested in this, I am. If the somebody calls you or me, and obviously if they call PTI, we say, hey, we got five, six people that are sitting right here. It's easy enough to
right.
do. If you call the Cubs, I don't know, let's say everybody in the place is their employee, which you're right, they're probably not.
They're not.
During the season, they probably average, or they're home half the time and away half the time. They average 3.5 games a week, three games a week.
Yeah.
Is that a yes on the employee of a beer vendor or a no, or is it part time? What is it? And then we'll take it one step further. Now, if it's the Bears and it's only 9 times a year for 5 hours, is that a yes? I don't know. Is it? I mean, that's what I'm asking.
Well, all these guys tend to be okay. So I don't know who does the contracting stuff now. But I mean, like Aramark was.
Let's just say they're all the Bears or all the Cubs.
Yeah. Yeah,
I'm more towards when do you have to say somebody's employed? If somebody comes in to clean the office here, 4 hours a week.
Employed is employed. If you're on a payroll, okay. An establishment survey asks you how many people. Okay,
well, beer vendors how now many? Probably are on the payroll. They probably didn't used to be. Okay.
Right. So I mean, but the thing is that it's the Bears. They wouldn't be Bears employees. They'd be employees of Aramark or whoever, you know, whoever's doing the concession, right? Now, you know, same thing with, I'm sure the Bears directly are probably not hiring the janitors that go around and, you know, clean up all the empty beer cups and...
Well, the park district would.
But then they're counted as employees by the park district. So, I mean, Now, on the household survey, they simply ask you, do you have a job? Okay. So, I mean, you know, so yes or no.
Would I count now, that as a job? I don't know. One day, ten days a year?
I don't know. I suppose you do. But by the way, table B4 shows a bunch of negatives on average, index of average weekly payroll. So it is showing up there as well as in the hours. So hours are being slashed. And these are, there are some fairly, boy, some of these numbers are not small. Retail, trade, transportation, warehousing, -0.7 and 0.8 on weekly hours. That's fairly serious. Mining and logging, -1.3 hours.
Whoa.
Now these are averages, of course. Information technologies, -1. Full hour.
When did this all?
Business services has rolled, and leisure and hospitality down -0.8. So the internals of this report are quite weak, Chief.
It sure seems like it.
Another
kind of procedural question. I keep asking this because I'm always looking at the you bring out the best in the numbers. I'm trying to figure out what goes in the numbers. When did it? I'll say when Andrew talked about when he was a young man. When I was a young man, if you got a job, it was 40 hours a week, and if there wasn't a lot of work that day, you kind of sat around. When did it become okay, even at like a Walmart or someplace, to say, it looks like it's going to rain on Thursday, 3 people don't show up? It used to be if somebody said, I'm paying you $10 an hour, you immediately said, that's $400 a week. Now, when did it become okay for that not to work that way? It seems like it's been
a
progression.
Obama did that.
Really? Okay. Because of Obamacare?
Right. Obama did that because if you went over 32 hours, then your employer got fined if they did not provide health insurance. And so as a result, and I mean, my daughter ran into this when she was first entering the workforce. And this, all of a sudden, when you do that, you're working, you know, retail places and, you know, stuff like this, right? And all of a sudden, out of the middle of nowhere, you're not even getting the 32. They won't let you work more than about 26 or 28. And the reason is, Joe calls in sick today and they need you to, you know, to work a double to make up his shift, right? Because they got to have the people on the floor. And you can't go over the 32 because then the employer gets fined. So they're cutting everybody off at like 26, 28 hours. Which, I mean, if you think about that, that's crazy.
Especially if you're paying to park. For God's sake.
Well, not only that, Chief, but it gets worse than that because what a lot of people did, and this you also see in the numbers, multiple job holders, okay, has skyrocketed. But there's a serious problem with this if you're an hourly employee, and that is if you wind up getting double scheduled on because of that situation. So you normally work Monday, say you work 12 to 4 at job one, and then you work 5 to 8 in job two, okay? The problem is you're in job one, and your boss turns around and says, we need to pull a double because Joe called in sick. If you do it, you get fired from the second place because you're a no-show. If you don't do it, you get fired from the first place. So this leads to all sorts of problems.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of trying, you know, as you, as the ordinary Joe, just trying to make your way, because the normal adjustment that people would apply to this kind of a problem is, I just take two jobs. Yeah, I don't get paid overtime, but I still get 40 hours.
Or Wednesday, Bruce or Andrew work for one of these big, very successful chicken joint chains now. And he would have different hours every day, even though he was only working 30-some hours. He couldn't possibly do another job.
Well, they do this all the time to you. And then the other thing is that a lot of what they've also, a lot of companies have started doing, and this has become extraordinarily prevalent, is sort of like a load board kind of situation in the transportation industry, where you have to bid for your hours in the ones that you want, you know, the 3 weeks from now, right? And the problem with that is you don't know where you're going to end up, because who has priority in that? To some extent, it's who's banging the keyboard the second they get released. But the rest of it is also, in many cases, is stratified by seniority. So if you're trying to make your way as a young adult and you're in that part of the economy, these jobs, it's impossible to make to earn a living wage working 20 hours a week. That's impossible.
I remember the minute somebody got a job, I won't say they were rolling in dope, but then you didn't have to worry about them affording dinner, you didn't have to worry about them affording a car. Now I remember the old cartoon. This was back when people still do political cartoons anymore.
Once in a while.
Clinton was sitting at this thing. It was a cartoon about Clinton, and he says, "Well, since I've been president, like nine million jobs have been created or something." And the guy putting down his rubber chicken dinner above his, "I know, I got four of them."
Yeah, well, there you go. But I mean, you know, this was one of the things that when Obama, this is one of the extraordinarily destructive effects of Obamacare. There were several, but that was one of the really, really big ones. And it has not gone away. And
I don't know why people didn't have the, you're supposed to be able to hire people that have, if somebody would have said that to, you know, a graduate class or even a regular class and said, if we do this, what are going to be the repercussions? It should have been obvious to everybody what was going to happen.
Well, as I pointed it out before it was passed. Well,
why didn't they do something intelligent, like saying, by the whole, I won't say the whole thing, but the big mess of this whole thing is that medical insurance payments and medical stuff is deductible for a company and not for an individual. Why don't we just change that?
Well, that doesn't solve the problem, Chief.
Well, it comes close. Why are companies even in the insurance business?
Tricky Dick Nixon was.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how that got embedded into the employment milieu of the United States, was that he, you know, wage and price controls, and this was the way that employers got around it. They couldn't raise wages, but what they could do was add a fringe benefit. So that was what they did, and that was essentially your raise that they couldn't give you because Nixon had imposed wage and price controls. So that was how it got stuck into the American experience, if you will. And once it happened, it was not going anywhere. Right?
Well,
it
just a simple, when the I actually was I just started.
Well, Chief, all right. So you asked, you know, why not just make it deductible, you know, to whoever?
I didn't say it would solve everything, but it's obvious it's a problem.
Well, actually, I don't think it would solve anything at all. And the reason is that the in-group preference problem, if you're a very small business, it doesn't so much come into play. But when you get a little bit bigger, it does. The fact that you know, I was a tiny little company when we first started doing this, when we first started offering that as a benefit, and you know, as when you get more than two or three people, you end up basically, in order to compete, you have to do it right. So we're doing that, but every single person in our company was individually rated. Now, by ERISA, I could not charge everybody a different price off their check. The law says I can't do that. this is a serious problem for small businesses. And if you don't think this leads to a crazy amount of under the table discrimination in hiring, you're dead wrong.
We had when we had doing a lot of futures stuff and everything else, and we were doing a lot of different types of stuff. We had I think two or three ladies of childbearing age.
Oh yeah, and then we had
two or three guys that were old. So we were absolutely. My brother goes, could we have hired any worse?
Well, you get in every hole you have.
Yeah,
right?
It was.
but I mean, it was just for listeners that don't understand this, how insane this really is. The highest, the lowest cost person, because I saw the entire sheet. It was. You know, protected health information. You could not get this to anybody. You'd get sued instantly and lose.
It's not protected health to know some lady's 30 years old. She's childbearing age. You know that.
But I could not disclose to anybody what that employee's cost was.
I get it.
I mean, I couldn't put that on your stub. I could, none of those kinds of things. But the range from highest to lowest was a factor of 10.
Well,
I mean that was. I mean that's nuts.
Hey, how about taking a? If you don't mind, can we shift gears a hair? What's going on? You're the only. I'll say the only guy, but my best guy. The gyrations that's going on in the, what everybody still thinks is the, homogenous, Big Seven that's turned to be nowhere near homogenous. What's going on there? Yesterday, Micron was down 100 points. Microsoft was up 14 points. With the pairs trade in here, if you knew which way to pair trade it, is dramatic. Who are the winners, or who are the buyers and the sellers out of the six or seven, and who's the winner or the loser as this goes forward? That's a tough question.
Chief, everyone's about to be the loser. The cracks are starting to show up. There's an article up on CNBC this morning that NVIDIA is now literally vendor financing startups by selling them compute time. All right. This is exactly what blew Lucent into tiny little pieces all over the floor. It is precise, and they've been doing this through the back door with some hinky stuff for a while. Now
they're talking about that a year ago. They financed a couple companies to buy their stuff, right?
But now they're actually selling compute time instead. Basically, they're financing your tokens in exchange. God help people if they don't understand where this is, what's going to happen here. They're doing this for a percentage, for revenue, for basically for a revenue share. All right. Good. So this is now formal. Oh my God. I read that this morning. A hair on the back of my neck stood up. We are now at the point that they can't sell chips on a cash basis to customers. So now what they've got is they got a whole ton of this crap sitting somewhere. They power it up.
Because people don't want them, or they can't afford them, or what's the way?
Well, they don't have the money to pay, obviously, right? And they can't get the financing because you're a little startup company. You don't have crap. You can't go into the bond market like Elon did and get $25 billion worth of credit floated out by somebody. Yeah. So what are you doing? Well now, instead of buying the stuff or putting up a data center or buying time on someone else's data center, you're basically buying a compute power from NVIDIA, who already has it, and they've produced it. But obviously, people which would you rather do, Chief? Would you rather sit on your production and lease time to people, basically be CompuServe, right, sell timeshare time for all intents and purposes, or would you rather take the $5,000 or $20,000 or whatever it is for the Blackwell chip and make another one? Of course you'd rather do the second, right? It's off your sheet. You've got the profit. You put it in the bank, and then you build another one.
Well, a simple question. The client calls up, and we've got somebody stacked. Why is Micron down 100 and Microsoft up 15? Okay. What's the simple answer? Is there a simple answer
to that? Okay, the simple answer to this is that all of this run on the memory and storage side, whether it be RAM or it be disks and stuff like this, has come from the on-the-come bet that all this data center construction is going to continue, these system sales are going to continue, this CapEx is going to continue, and what you're seeing in the market is that model is cracking. And when it does, and this is, it, by the way, you may note, that the DOJ supposedly is going after Samsung, Micron, and SK Hynix supposedly for, you know, 15 U.S.C. Chapter 1.
Which is what?
That's monopoly.
Okay.
All right, and price fixing. And the reality of it is that every one of these companies has been around for decades. They've seen this movie before. They're not building capacity into this demand ramp because they know it's not going to last. And every one of them has come close to going bankrupt as a result of making that mistake in the past. And they're not going to do it again. So, but the collapse in that forward demand book, you're not seeing it. You know, Micron just had a nice earnings report, right? You know, didn't say nothing about anything like this, but it's being sniffed out by the market that is coming.
The guy said they're good to go through 2027.
Well, guess what? He's full of crap.
Well, that's what he said. That's what jacked up to $100.
I understand it's what he said. The market is saying it's a load of garbage that NVIDIA is not able to sell the actual Blackwell chips, that they're having to lease, essentially play CompuServe and lease time on a mainframe for all intents and purposes. And when you start to see that kind of a pattern in this sort of a cyclical business, Katie barred the door. The red flag is up, and anybody that's not paying attention to it here, boy, I hope you got puts because you're going to need them.
Well, because the Apple and the Microsoft are buyers, so if the prices drop, they're not going to get hurt as much as the guys that are selling the stuff, right?
Well, if prices drop, they're actually, I mean, assuming that they can raise prices into the consumer channel. Well,
they're
going to
try. They're trying.
Well, they're trying. Whether or not people will continue to buy at those prices is an open question, but assuming they get away with it, their margins expand.
Okay.
When the prices drop. Okay. However, the other guy whose stock price is entirely based upon a $500 for a set of RAM sticks that cost me $100 a year ago, he gets creamed because now it's $100 again. Right?
Well, I mean, what you guys were talking about the other day with the, the T-Mobile, essentially, you were talking about where everybody all of a sudden they were never supposed to raise prices and they did.
Yeah,
and the people who they're essentially financing your phone. So if somebody goes to T-Mobile someplace and they finance the Apple phone, and the Apple phone is $200 more than it was before, so now it's what, $1,400 instead of $12 or something.
Right.
And you finance it for a year, you're talking, what are you talking? You're talking $15 more a month, right?
Yeah, I mean the problem here is that. So the other thing that T-Mobile's game with this is that people won't jump onto the MVNOs, which, you know, there's 100 of them out there now, right? U.S. Cellular and all these other guys, which just basically buy excess capacity from the main carriers.
They're selling it to them, right? I have one of those, and I think I'm on the AT&T network.
Right, but here's the thing, Chief. To go on the MVNO, the problem is you have to bring your own device, generally, or you have to pay for it, because the reason that the main carriers think they can get away with this crap is that you didn't buy your new iPhone. You are paying for it over 24 months in your bill. If you want to leave T-Mobile and you've got that out there and you still owe $500 on that iPhone, you got to fork up the $500.
Well, I just bought mine. So I just bought it from, I think I'm
well, well, I buy mine for cash too, which means that I can tell, you know, I mean, I'm on T-Mobile right now, but I'm going to shop this as soon as I find out exactly what the number is. And if it doesn't make any sense, sayonara, jackasses, I'm leaving.
Yep, I get it.
So, you know, we'll see how that, but I can do that because I own the device. And therefore, I can move it, you know, it'd take me half an hour to move it over onto somebody on some other carrier. If you happen to have a $500 or $600 balance on your device, you don't have the $500, you're stuck. You're stuck, yeah.
Well, all right, but what are you doing for the weekend? You guys got fireworks near you?
Well, I'm sitting over in the sort of halfway through Tennessee, was doing some hiking and having some fun with a fine individual who I am with, and
good for you.
We headed towards home because being around any of that insanity during the actual 4th, nah, I probably won't be doing that.
Yeah, I'm
probably gonna have a pork butt on the smoker, and that'll be about it.
I think it'll be a big show out by Audrey's in New Orleans, so maybe we can see that from afar. That's good enough.
Oh no, I have to be close enough that I can feel them in my chest. Otherwise, it's
oh good. God. Well, actually, all her friends, I said, hey, what if we do a cookout? And she goes, well, nobody wants to come over. He's got to be home and take care of their dogs. The dogs all get petrified.
Well, here's the other thing is all through the weekend, it's, you know, 100 degrees.
Yeah.
I mean, this heat dome thing over the Midwest is nuts, but
they're talking about we were supposed to be over that today. I don't think that's going to happen. Anyway, bud.
I think you're stuck with it through the weekend, yeah.
All right, bud, take care of yourself, and we'll talk to you on Tuesday. I'll bet we're going to have some something to talk about on Tuesday.
Oh, I'm sure. This ought to be a interesting next few days. Anyway.
Oh, God.
Here we
good
go.
Good job, Jimmy. Back, where are we? S&P futures are, let's see, let's get rid of this so we can say what they are. S&P's up 18, NASDAQ futures up 86. They were up a little bit after this report, but now they're sinking back down again. Back on Monday, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.